Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter,
and grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with changemakers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.
Our press secretary gave alternative facts to that.
My goal in this deposition was to be truthful, but not particularly helpful.
Welcome to Unspun, the podcast that makes you better at finding the truth. The way people get news is changing. It used to be that there were many reporters who would research stories and write articles, but now politicians and famous people share information directly with you on social media and the internet. That means you find out things fast, but it's up to you to make sure the information's actually accurate. And newsmakers don't always do their part. The temptation to manipulate information is strong. They bend the truth to deceive so that they can avoid accountability, so that they can advance their agendas. When you recognize these agendas, you can sometimes find out what's real. And we're at a crossroads where anyone can share anything online, so it's important to sharpen your critical thinking skills. Finding that deception before it goes viral is pretty much a survival skill now, and we're going to do it together. Let's get unspun. Hello, truth seekers, and welcome to this week's Unspun. In this episode, we'll be looking at how sometimes humor is used as a weapon. And then we'll be digging into investigative reporting. What does it mean? What does it take? What's its value? And why is it getting harder to come by? Sound good? Let's get unspun. So, you know, sometimes newsmakers say things that are unfortunate for them. It might be in a speech or it might have been in a social media post, but they say something that rubs the audience the wrong way. And rather than face up to the harm that they've caused, they sometimes take a different approach and they say, oh, it was just a joke. Donald Trump said this after his Russia, if you're listening, comment about Hillary Clinton emails. And Joe Biden did it after he said, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, then you ain't black. Although Biden did later apologize for that. So what's going on here? Researchers would call this humor being used as a deflection, basically trying to make an offense seem less offensive. And this can work in a couple of ways. It can create uncertainty. Did they mean to say something terrible? How can I know if they were actually meaning to joke, especially if I only get the words in written form, so I can't tell their tone or if they were waggling their eyebrows? How can I criticize someone if I'm not even sure they meant to do something wrong? So when the president shares a message saying, long live the king, and his official communication office shares a photo of him with a crown on, how are people supposed to react? Do they laugh along with him? Do they reply that the U.S. fought a revolution to not have kings? Calling something like this a joke changes the responsibility, because we don't talk about what the person actually said, we talk about the people who can't take a joke. And this leads to a concept called weaponizing unhumor. This is where someone says something on purpose to get outrage from others. The person who says it can then claim that they're a victim. They can go on to say that they're fighting against political correctness or cancel culture, you know, champion free speech. And when they do this, they actually increase their power because it seems like just about any critic is unhinged. And an article in the Journal of American Folklore said, quote, how do you fight an enemy who's just kidding? This is actually the basis of some trolling as well. So the next time that a newsmaker tries to say that their hurtful words were just a joke, remember that humor can be a weapon. Okay, on to the main topic for today, investigative journalism. Let's meet Ida B. Wells. Sources describe her as being striking, both in how she looked and in her tenacity as a reporter. She stood about 5 feet tall, and she had a petite frame. She had black hair and dark eyes, which sources described as intense and expressive. Wells was well known for her composed demeanor, and she often dressed elegantly, which kind of reflected the seriousness with which she approached her work. If you look at photographs of her from the late 19th and early 20th centuries, you see a petite African-American woman with an updo, in stylish dresses and hats, right in the fashion of the era. But she was much more than a style icon. She was fiercely intelligent, she was articulate and passionate about justice. She was really known for her tenacity and resilience, qualities that she really needed in her reporting, which was a fight against racial injustice and, in particular, lynching. She had really significant threats and opposition, but she remained steadfast in this mission to expose the truth and to advocate for civil rights. She was actually born into slavery in 1862 in Holly Springs, Mississippi. After the Civil War, her family was freed, and she grew up in the Reconstruction era. Despite the challenges of her life and her family, she was an excellent student and eventually became a teacher. And then in 1892, her close friend Thomas Moss owned a successful grocery store called the People's Grocery, and it was in a neighborhood called The Curve, just outside of Memphis, Tennessee. The People's Grocery was owned by 11 prominent African Americans, and it was vital to the local black community. It also threatened a local white-owned store nearby, owned by a man named William Barrett. And so conflict began on March 2nd of 1892, when a fight broke out between a black boy named Armour Harris and a white boy named Cornelius Hurst over a game of marbles outside the store. Hurst's father jumped in and he started beating Harris, and two People's Grocery employees came out to help the boy. The confrontation turned into a larger brawl between black and white residents, and during the fight, William Barrett was struck. Barrett later identified William Stewart, the one who hit him, and the next day, Barrett returned to the store with a police officer, demanding to arrest Stewart. When another employee named Calvin McDowell informed them that Stewart wasn't there, Barrett hit McDowell with his revolver, knocking him to the ground. McDowell picked up the dropped gun, fired at Barrett, but missed. And McDowell was subsequently arrested, and he was released on bond. But then on March 9th, a white mob, including police officers, forcibly removed Moss, Stewart, and McDowell from their jail cells and took them to a remote location outside of Memphis and brutally lynched them. Moss, Stewart, and McDowell were shot multiple times, and their bodies were left to rot in the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad Yard. Now, Ida B. Wells was deeply moved by this, and it motivated her to investigate and document lynching in the United States. She was an investigative reporter. She meticulously collected data on lynching cases by reviewing newspaper reports, court records, and other public documents, noting the names of the victims, the alleged crimes, and the circumstances of the lynchings. She used sources as well. She often interviewed witnesses and victims' family members to gather firsthand accounts, and this gave her a more comprehensive and kind of accurate portrayal of the incidents. And she cross-referenced this information with multiple sources, so she was comparing those newspaper articles, the legal documents, the personal testimonies. She published all of her findings in a bunch of places, articles, pamphlets, and books, and her piece, Southern Horrors, Lynch Law in All Its Phases, was published in 1892. And it gave really detailed accounts and challenged the justification for those acts, kind of revealing that lynchings were often premeditated acts of violence that were mostly aimed at maintaining racial hierarchy. She was determined. She even had threats to her life, and she moved to Chicago, but she continued her advocacy. She traveled to the North and even to Europe, and she gave lectures raising awareness about the horrors of lynching and advocating for anti-lynching legislation. Wells also published The Red Record, a comprehensive compilation of lynching statistics, which gave really detailed narratives about individual cases. And she was an early example of what we call investigative reporting. Investigative journalism is like a really deep dive kind of story. It's not simply repeating what someone else has said, quoting people or something like that, but it involves original research and in-depth reporting to uncover the truth. Investigative journalists often work in teams on an idea, and their investigation starts with a hunch or a question about something that doesn't seem right. And then they collect facts, they look at data, they search public records to see if that hunch is correct. And they also track down people, follow the money, and examine how organizations work to find out what's really happening, because their goal is to reveal things that are hidden from the public, particularly when powerful people or groups are doing something wrong. Investigative journalism is different from simply reporting on crime or even sharing leaked documents, because it's about identifying the root causes of problems, and then holding people accountable. And this kind of work not only takes multiple people, but it can take weeks and sometimes months to accomplish. This type of journalism is important, though, because it can lead to new laws and policies by exposing problems, and it helps the public understand important issues and to really make informed decisions. It shines a light on problems and systems that are supposed to be helping people who are struggling. You know, so in that way, it protects those who can't protect themselves. And in some parts of the world, like in Latin America, investigative journalists work together because it helps them make a bigger impact, to reach more people, to stay safe, and even to fight against government censorship. So let's talk about some techniques that investigative journalists use. Imagine a detective who loves numbers and computers. That's essentially what data-driven investigation is all about. It's the art of finding clues hidden within vast amounts of information, using computer programs and mathematical techniques to uncover patterns that you wouldn't notice just by looking at it. You know, you could think of a city spending millions on a new infrastructure project. A data-driven investigator might download all the contracts, the payment records, and the performance reports related to the project. And then they'd use software and statistical methods to look for unusual patterns, such as a company being paid excessively for its services compared to what most companies would make, or the project running over budget consistently and being behind schedule. And these kind of patterns could indicate potential corruption or maybe even fraud. There's also public record and document-based investigation. This is like using the government's own files against it. So you're using the power of transparency to hold institutions accountable. Governments and other organizations generate vast quantities of records, meeting minutes, financial reports, emails, and more, and often those are accessible to the public. An investigator could use laws like the Freedom of Information Act, which I talked about in Episode 11, to request these documents. For example, if there are allegations of a politician accepting bribes, an investigator could request their travel records, financial disclosures, and communications to uncover any evidence of wrongdoing. The investigation into the Flint, Michigan water crisis exemplifies this technique. Journalists use public records, including internal emails and water quality reports, to demonstrate how government officials knew about the lead contamination problem, but didn't protect the public. Now, other investigations use source-based. At its core, source-based investigation is about the power of human connection and really about the importance of listening. So it's about finding individuals who possess inside knowledge of a situation. These might be employees, maybe whistleblowers, community members, and you build trust with them to uncover the truth. The reports on Clarence Thomas accepting travel from people was largely done with source-based investigation. So they had people who were obviously there on the site who provided, for example, photos. Or you could imagine a hospital that's suspected of medical malpractice. And an investigator would look at doctors and nurses and former patients to get their stories and their perspectives. And the more people they engage with, the better the picture becomes. And so you can find these patterns of negligence or misconduct. Another strategy is asking the experts. So this emphasizes the importance of backing up your investigative findings with solid evidence from experts and research. So this is kind of like doing your homework, right? Ensuring that your reporting is grounded in credible sources and that it's informed by expert knowledge. So an investigator might look at academic studies. They might look at expert reports, think tank reports, databases, to understand the context of an issue and to kind of provide support for their findings. So for example, if you were examining the effects of a new pesticide, you might consult scientific studies on the pesticide's toxicity and its environmental impact, and you might even call up and interview experts in the field. Investigations into the health effects of vaping demonstrated this approach. And journalists have used scientific studies and expert opinions from doctors and researchers to report on the potential risks with e-cigarettes. So these are some of the foundational principles that underpin all effective investigative work. It involves approaching a subject in a systematic way, right? You formulate a hypothesis, you test it with evidence, and you're really just going deeper than surface level reporting. So for example, if you're investigating a potentially corrupt business, the investigator would begin with a central question. Is this business truly corrupt? Gather as much information as possible, and then rigorously test the hypothesis by seeking evidence of fraud or unethical conduct. So Seymour Hersh's reporting on the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War kind of exemplifies these techniques. He used in-depth reporting, original research, engaged with sources to expose the truth about the massacre, even though the government tried to cover it up. And it shows that the power of traditional investigative methods can challenge censorship and hold power accountable. All right, I need to take a quick break, but when I come back, we'll talk about a few specific investigative stories, as well as the future of investigative work. I'll be right back. Welcome back. One well-known investigative piece is the Boston Globe's Spotlight, and they used a whole range of investigative reporting techniques in their Pulitzer-winning investigation of the Catholic Church's cover-up of abuse. Their investigations were done by three reporters and an editor, and it exemplifies how a bunch of different methods working together can uncover hidden truths and lead to really substantial social impact. Part of the investigation was a systematic look at what was really going on, so they actually created a database of bad priests to track priests over 20 years, including where they were assigned to work and any accusations of abuse. This involved reviewing huge amounts of information, including archdiocese phone books, which the reporters described as tedious and monotonous, and that it took more than 3 weeks. The Spotlight team's work involved original research as they uncovered facts and found connections that had been concealed for decades. They also got personal stories, though, about people who interacted with the priests. In fact, the team spoke to almost 300 victims of abuse, and many of them were sharing their experiences for the first time. This let them get essential information and find patterns of abuse. And it was a multi-pronged investigation, so they also looked at schools, interviewing dozens of former employees, as well as students, parents, and teachers who all shared some of the really disturbing details. They had a story on failure in care, and they spoke with residents of a facility, their family members, advocacy organizations. One reporter spent weeks speaking with a former resident of a facility to tell a really tough story. You may have heard of Spotlight because there was a pretty good movie that came out about it, but you may not have heard about one of the biggest investigative products in our lifetimes, the Panama Papers. This story starts with a leak. It was a leak of 11.5 million documents, and this is a staggering 2.6 terabytes of data, more data than Edward Snowden had. And it came from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca. This firm specialized in setting up offshore entities, or what we might call shell companies, for clients around the globe. And the documents that they got, going all the way back to the 1970s, had really sensitive financial and attorney-client information. They still don't know who leaked them. The source is only known as John Doe, and he's anonymous to this day because of concerns for safety. But John Doe contacted the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung, or SZ, with the offer of this data. SC saw that this was an enormous task, so they partnered with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, or ICIJ, and this sparked a global, unprecedented collaboration. There were more than 370 journalists from more than 100 media organizations across 76 countries joining forces in this work. They spent months analyzing the data, and they used sophisticated software as well as traditional reporting methods. They tracked down leads, they cross-referenced information with public records, they sought comment from people who were implicated, and the goal or the hypothesis was that there were hidden dealings for politicians and celebrities and the ultra-wealthy. And the Panama Papers were released on April 3rd of 2016, and it really sent shockwaves around the world. They exposed the offshore holdings of 12 current or former world leaders, 128 other public officials and politicians, and just countless celebrities and business figures. And what these leaks showed is that these individuals used shell companies to evade taxes, they laundered money, they got around international sanctions. And while owning an offshore company isn't always illegal, the Panama Papers showed how these entities were often used for illegal things. And there were big, big repercussions. The Prime Minister of Iceland resigned. Pakistan's Prime Minister was imprisoned. Governments around the world launched investigations and they recovered millions of dollars in unpaid taxes. And in some countries, they even passed new laws to combat tax evasion and to increase financial transparency. Mossack Fonseca, the law firm that was at the center of the scandal, was under intense scrutiny, and eventually its founders were arrested on money laundering charges, although they were acquitted in June of 2024, citing insufficient evidence. The Panama Papers also sparked a broader conversation about tax havens in general and financial secrecy. And so some organizations like Oxfam pointed to tax havens as really important in global income inequality, highlighting the role of international banking and just the fact that countries need to cooperate to combat tax evasion. It was really a landmark case of collaborative journalism because it showed the power of data-driven reporting and the importance of holding the power accountable and the way that this can even drive social change and changes in laws and things like that. I don't want to sound like everything in investigative is big because there's examples of investigative journalism on a smaller local level too. You know, for example, Joe Bruno's work on vote collecting in rural North Carolina, which I talked about in episode 25. I want to close just by noting that the economics of the news industry are making investigative journalism a lot more rare. Like I said, these kind of investigations often require a lot of staff and can take a lot of time. And the time that staff spends on these big investigations is time they're not reporting daily stories. So investigative work is a big investment for a news organization. But when it's well done, it can literally make the world a better place. Thanks for getting Unspun with me this week. Unspun is a production of me, Amanda Sturgill, and is a proud member of the MSW Media family of podcasts. Send me your thoughts and ideas about trickery in the news on Gmail at theunspunpodcast@gmail.com. I even write back. And find this episode's show notes and more information at theunspunpodcast.substack.com. Want to learn more and get smarter? Check out my book, Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News, which is available on Amazon or your favorite online bookseller. And until next time, stay sharp, everyone. It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.